Okay, we're just going to head straight into the situation in England. Apologies that you're going to have this translated. I'm a solicitor, a lawyer in England, and I specialise in acting for adults who lack capacity. And we have been involved in a number of cases which involve capacity to marry or capacity to consent to sex. The three of us are all going to speak for about 15 minutes, which is not very long to try and cover the law in England. What I'm going to do is give an introduction to the main piece of legislation, which is the Mental Capacity Act 2005, and then in particular how the law has been interpreted about the capacity to marry and the capacity to consent to sex. And again, it's how the British Parliament has tried to grapple with that problem of should the law protect vulnerable adults from sexual abuse, or should the law empower adults to be able to enjoy and engage in marriage and in sexual relations. And you'll see that the way that the courts have interpreted this has ended up being the latter. And so the test about whether somebody has the capacity to marry or capacity to have sex is quite a low one, which allows adults with acquired brain injuries or other conditions, lifelong learning disabilities, to still engage in and enjoy sexual relations. The whole area is governed, as I said, by the Mental Capacity Act, came into force in 2007. And what the Act says right at the start is that a person is unable to make a decision for themselves if at the key time they're unable to make that decision because of an impairment or disturbance of the mind or brain. That doesn't tend to be particularly controversial. It's not issues which are challenged in the court. But the question is, what does it mean to be unable to make that decision for yourself? And so the Act goes on to say that somebody is unable to make this decision if they can't either understand the information, they can't retain or remember the information, or they can't use or weigh that information, or they can't communicate their decision. And it's the use or weigh that tends to be the most difficult. So can somebody understand the various options and then decide which one of those that they want to proceed with? What the Act then says is that if somebody lacks capacity to make a decision, and so as it says there on the slide, this could be about their care, it could be about where they live, it could be about who they're having contact with, it could be about medical treatment, whatever it may be. If somebody lacks the capacity to make that decision for themselves, you then go on to the next stage, which is to say, well, what is in this person's best interests? And you'll hear from John shortly, who will be involved on a day-to-day basis about making decisions in the best interests of an adult who lacks the capacity to make it themselves. However, there are certain excluded decisions in the Act which say there is no best interest decision. And for the purpose of today, the important point here is sex and marriage are both excluded decisions. So what that means is there is no best interest decision. Either you have the capacity to marry or the capacity to have sex and then you can, or you lack that capacity and then you can't. And it is a criminal offence to have sex with somebody who would lack the capacity to consent to sex. So you can see straight away it's obviously a very, very important decision. If you decide somebody lacks the capacity to consent to sex, it means they cannot. It would be an offence for anybody to have sex with that person. So the courts then have to grapple with, well, what does it mean to have the capacity to marry? Or what does it mean to have the capacity to consent to sex? And the first case, which was my law firm in 2004, came before a judge, and the question was, what does that mean? And what the judge says, it doesn't mean whether you have capacity to marry this particular person. it's not about marrying one person over another person, but looking at generally, do you have the capacity to marry? Do you understand what marriage means? And it was particularly important in that case because the individual wanted to marry somebody who their family and their friends thought was not a good person to marry. And the court said, it's not relevant who that person is. The only thing that is relevant is, do you understand marriage? And the same judge then went on in a subsequent case 2 years later to drill down again. Well, what does marriage actually mean? And so what the judge said is that it's a contract which people choose to enter into and includes engaging in sexual relations. And so a sexual relationship is assumed to be part of being married. And so what that means is if you lack the capacity to consent to sex, you will also lack the capacity to marry. Because if you can't have sex, it's assumed that's part of marriage. But the reverse is not necessarily true. You may have the capacity to consent to sex, but lack the capacity to marry because you don't understand all of the other things that are part of marriage. And in England, this has become more and more controversial because it's quite an old-fashioned view of what marriage is. The judge, for example, talked about the fact that it's to the exclusion of all others, when in fact people now will say, well, actually, various people are married and are not, but also have other partners, etc., and their marriage continues. But that is the law as it stands in England. So the question then is, well, what does it mean to be able to consent to have sex? And so what the judge said is that it involves a low level of understanding. The judge did not want to set the bar very high, which would then prevent people from being able to engage in sexual relations. And so he said what it requires, is whether the person understands the sexual nature of the act. Do you understand physically what it means to have sex? But that knowledge and understanding need not be sophisticated. It's, do you understand how to have sex? Do you understand that sex can lead to pregnancy? Do you understand sexually transmitted diseases? And if you understand those things, you have capacity to consent to sex, and if you don't, you will then lack it. So he said it is enough that she, in this case, has sufficient knowledge of what the act comprises and its character to enable her to decide whether to give or to withhold consent. So far, so good, but the matter then became very complicated in England when a case went to the very highest court in England, a criminal case, not a civil case, about capacity to consent to sex. And Baroness Hale, who's a very liberal-minded judge in England, appeared to disagree with what was being said there and said that capacity to consent to sex should be related to the particular individual. So she said, it's difficult to think of an activity which is more person-specific than having sex. You don't decide to have sex with the world. You decide to have sex with this person at this time, on this day, and that the test, therefore, should be person-specific. And so whereas I said before that marriage was, can I understand marriage generally? Sex is, can I understand sex generally? Baroness Hale was saying, that's not right. It should be actually specific to the individual. There was lots of concern amongst practitioners then about how would that be implemented. Are you going to have to follow this person round in a nightclub saying you can have sex with this person but you can't have sex with that person? And the matter then was resolved in a court case last year. And it's the case that's on the screen. The facts of the case, very briefly, are that there was a 41-year-old woman. She had three children. She had a history of drug and alcohol abuse and convictions for prostitution. During surgery for liver disease, she then had a cardiac arrest, which led to a brain injury. And it was considered that following that brain injury, she lacked the capacity to make decisions about her residence and about her care and about her contact. Prior to the brain injury, she'd been in a relationship for a long time, for a number of years, with a man who's known as LM, who himself had a significant criminal record. And it was thought that she lacked the capacity to consent to sex because she couldn't weigh the risks to her of having future children if she became pregnant. And the court had to consider whether that was relevant to whether or not she was able to have sex with him. And what the Court of Appeal decided was that that wasn't relevant and that the test, again, is a low test. So it taking us back to, it is just about, do you understand how to have sex? Do you understand you can get pregnant? Do you understand sexually transmitted diseases? So why then is there a difference between the civil law and the criminal law? And the reason why that was justified was because the civil law is looking forward. It's saying, here's this individual. In this scenario, what will happen? And the criminal law is looking backwards and saying this scenario has already taken place. At that time that this sexual encounter took place, did that person have capacity to consent to it or not? And so the criminal law, which is governed by a different piece of legislation, the Sexual Offences Act of 2003, looks at... that there is an offence to cause a person to engage in sexual activity without consent. And this comes to partly what's been talked about already today, this idea about where does pimping come into assisting somebody else to engage in sexual relations. And so you can see there, to cause a person to engage in sexual activity without consent could be... It could be interpreted that if you are assisting this person, that you may then falling foul of the criminal law. And what we suggest is that cause a person should just have a common sense approach to what that means. And there's a practical solution to this that we adopt and we advise people to adopt, which is often, for example, if you're managing somebody's funds to... include within that an activity budget or to allow free time so that this individual then has some funds and they can be choosing on their own volition to engage in sexual relations so that the caseworker or financial deputy or whoever is involved in that person's life isn't actually causing them to engage in the sexual activity. To some degree, you're facilitating it, but keeping one step back. But I recognise as well that, like we've heard in France perhaps, is something of a fudge, a merge to allow the civil law to allow people to enjoy engaging in sexual activities, and the criminal law, you may be committing offence to meet in the middle. That's me.
Bonjour. Je suis un médecin spécialisé dans les liaisons cérébrales, mais je vais parler en anglais, pardon. I work in clinical practice in the hospital in Newcastle, and I also work for our Court of Protection, which is the court that administers the Mental Capacity Act in our country. I want to talk a little bit about clinical assessment of sex. It's very important to recognise and explore people's pre-existing sexual choices when you're considering what they're choosing to do following a brain injury. London is a very sophisticated, cosmopolitan city, but where I live, we have people who have been in marriages, even though they're gay, they've never been able to express their sexuality. And sometimes we find after a catastrophic brain injury, people will want to change the way they express their sexuality. And we need to be very aware of issues of confidentiality in that. We've had a patient who came through our inpatient unit recently, who was a 22-year-old man who was a great big tough gangster from a fairly unpleasant part of town. And he'd had lots of girlfriends, he had a couple of children. But as we got to know him, he expressed to us that he was gay, he'd always been gay, and following his brain injury, he wanted to express his homosexuality, having hidden it all his life. And that was a very difficult thing to bring up, especially with his brothers, who used to spend the weekends hunting out people who were gay and hurting them. So we're wading into very, very difficult territory when we start talking about people's sexuality. And things come out into the open that perhaps may never have come out into the open before. As a doctor, I see a lot of people who become less interested in sex after a brain injury. This is something I think maybe 10 or 15 years ago people didn't look for quite so often. And if you ask people in a brain injury clinic about their sex drive or about their libido, a lot of people will say, it's vanished, it's gone, I'm not interested. Sometimes that's related to changes in hormone profile, but can also be related to mood disorders. Following a brain injury, it's very common to become depressed or become anxious. And with physical disabilities, whether they're neurological disabilities or whether it's scarring, you get an altered self-perception, and it can be difficult to relate your sexual desires with that altered physical reality. So quite often the problems we see is not about helping people to have sex, it's about helping people to want to have sex or learning to live with not wanting sex anymore. A more common referral is for people who are expressing more interest in sex. Now, sometimes people after a brain injury, particularly if you've got a damage to the front part of your brain, your basal frontal injury, will be more interested in sex and will have a higher sex drive. But what we see quite often is people are no more interested in sex, they're just talking about it more. They're just happier to express their desire, or they're less inhibited about expressing their desire. And it's very important to separate those two out clinically, because they have different ways of managing those problems. If you've got someone who's expressing their sexual desire openly, you can do behaviour modification programs, looking at the right way to express sexual desire. But sometimes a true increase in sexual drive can be the outcome of hormonal changes and can be more difficult to manage. We also need to think of the social impact of an acquired brain injury. We know that the rate of divorce and separation after a brain injury is huge. Some studies say 40%, some studies say 60%. And we also know that people who've had significant brain injuries, particularly people who've got both physical and cognitive changes after their brain injury, have limited social contacts. And I don't know, where did you meet your partner? I met my partner at work. If you're not going to work, if you're not going to clubs, if you're not playing tennis, where do you meet people? And there's still a stigma related to particularly some of the behaviour changes after brain injury. And people can be shunned, people make assumptions about what the person is behind the disability, reducing the chance to develop what for the rest of us we might be taking for granted. When we see patients, either in the clinical situation or if I'm seeing patients for the court, we worry about these five domains. Sometimes people's judgment changes after a brain injury. They might assume everybody's a friend, or they might assume that everybody's an enemy. Sometimes it's difficult to read social cues, either because of neurocognitive damage or because of visual impairment or hearing impairment. Sometimes people have difficulties making decisions and making choices. People can be very impulsive. And also, sometimes if your judgment's impaired and you're poor at reading social cues, you can be very vulnerable. And we find ourselves in the situation sometimes where we have somebody who has had, for example, a big personal injury case, has got maybe £1 million, maybe £2 million. And we do question the motives of why somebody would want to marry them. I was involved in a very interesting case of a gentleman who was very physically disabled, very cognitively disabled following a brain injury. He was aggressive. He used to spit. He used to bite. He was incontinent. He had no language. And I got a phone call from the nursing home one day saying that one of the carers, one of the people working in the nursing home, had taken him to the registrar's office and they got married. What do you think we should do? Now, this gentleman had a huge compensation fund, and we were fairly sure he didn't have the ability to make the decision to marry this woman or marry anybody. And we had to take that to court and ask a judge to decide whether the marriage was valid or not. And that is an example of a very vulnerable man meeting someone with very, very questionable motives. Organic personality disorder is a strange classification in ICD-10 and in DSM. And it includes altered sexuality. I've been working with people with brain injury for a very long time. I've never met a patient yet who's gone from being straight to gay or gay to straight or normative gendered to transgendered after a brain injury. I've met a lot of people who change what they say to people. And a much more common situation, I think, is people who are now saying what they've always felt. Alex has spoken a lot about how you assess capacity to consent to sex. There is a very low threshold, and children, when they start doing sexual education at school, they're watching videos, they're talking with their peers, they will have the knowledge at 11, 12, 13 of what goes where, what are the mechanics of the act, that having sex can result in pregnancy, and you can get sexually transmitted infections. So what we're asking is for someone to use information they might have had in their mind for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, but weigh it up as an adult. Capacity to sex to prostitution is a little bit different because there's another layer of complexity to consent to prostitution. You need to know the financial implications. And I think you should also know about the social stigma, whether or not having sex with a prostitute is going to help how you feel, so help with your self-perception. It might not be something you want your grandmother to know. It might not be something you want your wife to know. So there's a subtly different test for assessing capacity to consent to sex with prostitutes. And when you're assessing capacity to consent to sex, you need to consider this in the overall presentation. A lot of people, particularly in the immediate aftermath of the brain injury, and we're talking maybe the first year or so, will have fluctuating capacity. And sometimes that fluctuating capacity is because of the brain injury. Sometimes it's because of mood disorders. Sometimes it's because of medication. Sometimes it's because of physical illness. So we need to take that into account. And we also need to consider the element of decisions about contact. The test to make decisions about who you see is actually a much higher threshold than the capacity to consent to sex. So you can be in what seems a ridiculous situation where you can have capacity to have sex with your friend, but you don't have capacity to go and have coffee with them because you need to make a lot of more complicated decisions. So we're still in a mess. We're still finding our way through what's right, what's wrong. And working with the lawyers and with case managers like John, we're trying to put together some guidelines which has a balance between protecting vulnerable people, but also, as the speakers earlier in the legal presentations have said, about allowing people the right to sexual relationships. Thank you.
My job as a clinical case manager is to arrange services for people with a brain injury. And over the many, many years that I've been doing this job, inevitably over time, clients request the services of a sex worker or say that they would like to have sex. And I think we're all kind of coming from the same point of view, that we have a duty of care to help our clients. It's been touched on several times how fundamental the need to have sex is and sexual expression. So as a clinician involved with clients with a brain injury, inevitably we are led necessarily to trying to arrange these services for people. In so doing, we work with others, Janet, Alex, for example, psychologists and other therapists, and these matters are very rarely undertaken in isolation as a case manager. It tends to be as part of a team, which we'll come on to in other respects. So the backstory to the presentation that we're doing today has been, as this situation has developed over the years, it's become necessary and desirable to consult with Janet, to consult with people like Alex. And we've had a genuine interest in this topic for now, I think, probably a handful of years. And independently of this fascinating day today, probably about 2 years ago, we thought, ooh, it would be really good to do a paper on this topic for use within the UK. And then coincidentally, the EBIS idea was suggested by Neil, who's the moderator for today. So that is the... very briefly, the backstory for our presentation today. The mental capacity issue has been dealt with by Alex, and I think also the issue of trying to ensure that the brain injured individual is the, as much as possible, the driving force behind the request to have sex. In the UK, there's also been, and Alex can correct me here if I'm wrong, there's also been a bit of law that's about procuring and soliciting. I think soliciting is now no longer illegal, is that correct? Yeah. And soliciting was the very public trying to obtain sex, typified by the term curb crawling, where people would drive their cars along the edge of a road attempting to attract the attention of a sex worker. However, procuring is perhaps more relevant, and that is where the individual sex worker is in some way forced or compelled into the situation that they're in. And I think it's very important, and we'll come on to some of the ways that we can try and avoid being in a procuring situation in a few minutes. But avoiding procuring is certainly something within the UK that we would wish to try very hard so to do. In approaching the practical arranging of sexual services for clients, as a case manager, it's very sensible to look at risk assessment and risk management. All things carry a risk. It's an interesting topic about how risk-averse we can be as a society, and how risk aversion can be a disabling factor with respect to helping our clients. However, from a practitioner point of view, it is a sensible idea to look at the balance of risks, and hopefully in so doing, it will indicate that helping a client to access sex is actually a beneficial and hopefully low-risk thing to do. In constructing this this presentation, one of the perhaps ironically one of the most controversial areas that we touched on was that of family involvement. And there are some family situations where a client's family is very supportive of a client accessing a sex worker. There are other situations where, despite perhaps a client needing or wanting or asking for that service, a family may be antagonistic towards the idea. So in formulating our talk today, we touched on this, and I think perhaps that may have been, funnily enough, the most controversial aspect. But basically, although it may be sensible in many respects to consult with the client's family, there's no compelling reason so to do. So our obligation is to listen to the client and to try and enact what the client, him or herself, wishes. In the UK, I'm going to look to Alex on my right here in a second, paying for sex has never been an offence. Is that correct? Fascinating debate earlier on about the commoditisation of the body and the commoditisation of sexual services, which is a deeply, deeply fascinating topic and could probably be subject material for a whole day's conference or a whole day's discussion. However, in the UK, it's never been an offence to pay for sex or for money to be involved in that process, although there are aspects of that that have been offences, and we've touched on earlier on the label of pimping. And I wouldn't want to necessarily get into the legal side of that, more Alex's domain, but just to make the point that in the UK there is no offence to pay for sex. The phrase escort agencies was mentioned earlier on, and I think sort of ironically in that the word escort implies somebody keeping you company or someone being with you, while in reality, certainly in the UK, I think the majority of escort agencies are directly involved in the provision of sexual services. There are many agencies, escort agencies in our, I come from the same area as Janet, and in the northeast of England there are probably 6, 7, 8 escort agencies that directly provide sexual services. Some indeed have experience of and expertise in providing sexual services for people with disabilities as well, which is a very interesting topic, and I'll touch on that in a little while when I talk about my particular case presentation. One of the issues with the provision of sex workers and using escort agencies is that they do require cash payment. So certainly in the UK, I'm not aware of any, and I could be completely out of touch here, but I'm not aware of any escort agency that accepts credit card or check payments or anything of that nature. So immediately in helping clients to access this service, we are on the difficult grounds of perhaps going certainly against guidance with regard to tax and national insurance payments, and maybe we'll touch on this in terms of how that can be developed in the future. There's an organisation in the UK called TLC Trust, which stands for Tender Loving Care Trust. It's worthwhile looking up, actually, and I've no idea whether or not similar organisations exist in other countries in Europe. The TLC Trust sets out guidance for the use of sex workers. It itself approves, so to speak, certain sex workers for use with clients with disabilities. And it sort of sets out a sex workers' charter about the ethics and the correct approach to providing these services. Very definitely worth a look. On the ground, certainly in the northeast of England, female sex workers far outnumber male sex workers. I'm not sure of the precise proportion. I would guess by around about 10 to 1, something like that. I think it's a very interesting approximate statistic, and we could again talk about the reasons why it is that female sex workers seem to be very much more in demand, perhaps, than male. Also, there are transgender and gay sex workers also available as well. Most of the clients that I work with are sufficiently impaired to require support workers. And the role of a support worker cannot be underestimated in terms of its value. It's very rarely the case, in my experience, that clients out the blue will make a demand to their case manager to access a sex worker. Very often it's been after discussions with their support worker, and the skills and ethical grounding of the support workers who are helping clients is absolutely vital, because although the clinicians may think that they have the monopoly on therapeutic conversations with their clients, I think in reality probably support workers on the ground helping clients on a day-to-day basis have far more of those conversations, and those are the conversations that can bring to light a client's expressed wish to access a sex worker. The support workers are also vitally important in setting up the situation where a client can actually use a support worker, and trying to make sure that the whole matter is done in as appropriate manner as possible. I'd like to talk a little bit about an actual anonymised client, but a real client nonetheless. We'll call him Mike. And Mike was brain injured in a road traffic accident when he was about 14, 14 and a half years of age, prior to which point he'd had no sexual relationships, as far as we know. He's primarily physically disabled with severe ataxia, but also has significant cognitive impairments and a significant frontal impairment that makes it very difficult. I'm not pressing the buttons here, am I? I'm talking away there. Sorry about that. So Mike is now 37 years of age. Whoops. And, as I say, very ataxic, with a significant cognitive impairment. And he, on the back of being supported by his support workers, some time ago began to request that he access a sex worker. He has no family involved at all, but has developed a very, very close relationship, as I say, with his support workers. Following his request for access to a sex worker, I did a little bit of research into escort agencies in our area, and talked to two or three different escort agencies and asked whether or not any of their sex workers had experience in working with clients with disabilities. It turned out that two, I think, if memory serves, actually did. And we narrowed the situation down to two or three particular sex workers who had direct experience of working with clients with a brain injury. And in consultation with Mike, we eventually looked at, I'm saying we, it was Mike who did this, made the decision making. We looked at choosing one particular sex worker who subsequently visited Mike to very good effect. It's very noteworthy that it was not the case that immediately upon visiting that Mike actually had sex with this lady. Mike is a very keen graffiti artist, and he enjoys not only graffiti painting on walls, including his own garden walls, he also produces painted beer mats as well. And the first occasion when Mike met the lady concerned, he spent his time painting beer mats, which may seem in many respects a bit of a misuse of the sex worker's time. However, it was far from the case. It was a way of beginning to formulate a relationship with this lady that's continued on from that day. The effects of the introduction of a sex worker to Mike were quite profound, and it wasn't only this in isolation that led to significant improvement in Mike's overall condition. It was also related to other positive developments in his life, such as him expanding his graffiti artwork. However, the provision of a sex worker in due course helped to reduce Mike's sexual frustration. That also enabled him to become a more socially skilled individual. The sex worker was also specifically asked to help Mike with regard to his behaviours towards females in general. Prior to this, Mike had the unfortunate tendency to very skilllessly try and chat up women in local pubs, and very often that had led to him being subject to minor assault. So there was a very high risk of Mike being injured, of sustaining further brain injuries in that kind of situation. So the sex worker concerned was tasked to talk to Mike about how it would be more sensible to behave in different ways. That worked, and Mike's behaviour towards females improved generally. His self-esteem increased hugely. His confidence increased hugely. The quality of conversations that he was able to have with both support workers and other involved clinicians improved. And as one factor in amongst several, it led to a very significant improvement in Mike's quality of life and overall profile of different behaviours. Both the support workers and I'll say a little bit about how it works with the support workers in a second, but Mike's got to know the particular sex worker quite well now, and the issue of whether or not that person chooses to be in that situation fully has been quite carefully explored, and my impression is that the lady concerned fully chooses to be in that situation, and the reason why she's working in that field is in order to save up sufficient money to go on to do a professional qualification and study at university. So for her, it's simply a means to an end. All in all, I think the situation has been a great success. The support workers retire to a safe distance away from Mike's home when this is occurring. There have been no instances of any challenging behaviour towards the sex worker concerned at all. The discussions throughout the whole of today seem to reflect this question of balance about, on the one hand, we have a requirement, a duty to help our clients, but the systems, the legal systems, the culture, etc., that we operate within may not always make that easy. There is an issue around professionals being risk-averse in wanting to protect ourselves necessarily rather than taking legitimate risk in assisting the client. I think certainly in the UK, and I think this seems to be reflected in the discussions this morning, there does appear to be a shift in culture, a cultural change, perhaps particularly over the last 5 to 10 years, which is, I think, very good news for our clients. In terms of the next steps, and I'm speaking personally here, not necessarily for my other colleagues on my right-hand side, but I think it would be sensible to see some degree of regulation, some recognition for the role that the sexual surrogates or sex workers perform. I think there are issues around the cash economy and the problems that can lead to. But, hey, it's a great start, and it's been a fascinating day so far. Looking forward to the afternoon. It's been very, very illuminating to compare what we're doing in the UK with what's going on in the rest of Europe. And thank you very much.
Very curious to know what questions or comments follow that talk.
Merci. Je rebondis un petit peu sur la question de la dame au premier rang. Là, est-ce que vous avez aussi eu dans vos dossiers des demandes de femmes pour un aidant sexuel à leur homme? Et si ces demandes sont également entendues et si on trouve tout aussi facilement des solutions?
I haven't had any requests from women for male sex workers. We seem to have the other problem with women, which is maybe women being exploited by men or husbands or partners having sex with women with brain injury when the women aren't actually that interested in it. But I've never had a woman asking for those kind of services.
John. funnily enough, on that subject, I had first formal request from a female client of mine. I had the first formal request from a female client of mine, a young lady with cerebral palsy. Neil will probably think of the particular young lady in question. But about a week and a half ago, for a sex worker, a male sex worker, the lady's cerebral palsy is a life-limiting condition, and she used the phrase, "I'd like to not die a virgin." And the, I think realistically, in the near future, probably the only way that she will be able to have sex is by using a male sex worker, so she's requested that I look into that for her.
We do get female patients, however. We do have female patients, however, who are interested in sex but aren't necessarily interested in sex with men. And the questions we have from women are more about, if I use a vibrator, will it trigger my epilepsy or another bleed? And to be honest, I think maybe the women prefer the vibrators to the men.
Surely not.
Sorry.
Ici à Bruxelles, en tout cas, j'entends de plus en plus de demandes de femmes. Et en fait, c'est plus compliqué de trouver un travailleur du sexe masculin qui voilà. Donc.
Have we silenced everybody? I think then we can thank everybody for a fantastic morning and we can move on to lunch. So thank you very much.
On va prendre une heure de pause. On respecte pas vraiment le programme, mais il faut respecter nos traductrices. Donc on se retrouve dans une heure. Merci.